Case number 13-1090, Peter Koretsky et al. Appellants v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. Mr. Samahone for the appellants, Ms. Hauser for the appellate.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tuan Samahun, and I appear pro bono on behalf of the taxpayers, the Koretskys. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This is the taxpayers' timely filed appeal from a final judgment of the U.S. Tax Court. That tax court judge was subject at all times by statute to removal by the president on grounds for malfeasance, inefficiency, and neglect of duty. Terms that the Supreme Court called in Boucher versus Sinar is very broad, interpreting those verbatim terms, and that the court said at 727 note 5 created a here and now subservience of the officer subject to removal at the hands of the authority with the removal power. And it was because of the strong presumption.
So before you go there, before you get into the teeth of the merits, the tax court decided that the argument as to the constitutional competency of the tax court should have been raised initially with the tax court before a motion to vacate.
That's correct. It should have been raised earlier in the proceeding. We did raise it with the tax court in a timely filed motion to vacate under Tax Court Rule 162. Our position was that it was because Tax Court Rule 162 recognizes all those grounds for vacation that are available in Federal Rule Civil Procedure 60, including 60B4, that it's void, the judgment is void because it's fundamentally infirm. The allegation of fundamental infirmity, we allege, is that separation of powers violation here, namely that a judicial officer is subject to presidential removal.
If the Supreme Court in Mistretta said that nothing in Boucher suggests that one branch may never exercise removal power, however limited, over members of another branch, indeed we've already recognized that the president may remove a judge who serves on an Article I court, relying on McAllister.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor, that Justice Blackmun did say that in note 35 in Mistretta. He goes on, though, to note what is the paramount concern of the separation of powers. This was not the instance where the president wielded power to remove members of the Sentencing Commission, not from their officers as judges, but rather from their positions as individuals serving on the Sentencing Commission for that particular assignment. This is the paramount concern that he observed would exist, to wit, the removal of an officer from one's core functions, that is, the control that one branch, or rather I should say one power, has over the other. In this case, the executive power that the tax collector in chief has over judicial officers.
You're relying on McAllister, which is a district judge.
I don't rely on McAllister.
You're confusing. You can have judicial power exercised in an Article I or an Article III context. You've conflated the notions badly. The Supreme Court has never said what you've said. Congress makes the decision within certain limits as to whether to put certain functions in Article III or Article I. There are clear limitations. And you can have judicial power being found in both. So it's not a question of whether there is judicial power that decides the separation of powers question, and that's why Mr. Mistretta wipes that away. Your argument makes no sense.
I agree that McAllister says that the president may have an authority to remove territorial court judges, which was what was at stake in that particular case.
Right.
But it did not say that the territorial court exercised the judicial power of the United States. In 1991, Justice Blackmun said that the tax court of the United States exercises the judicial power of the United States. The IRS is trying to argue.
There are a lot of entities and officials other than Article III judges who exercise some part of the judicial power.
Right.
Who may not have life tenure. They may be removable. They may just have terms of years. But e.g., bankruptcy judges and magistrate judges exercise some part of the power without being Article III judges.
That's correct, Your Honor. As Judge Suntell notes, that in the Freitag majority, the court said, let's compare the function. So rather than look at the characteristics of office, which was what Justice Scalia's dissent did, said, let's look at the characteristics of the office. And they said they exercise many of the same functions that district court judges do. They looked at the 1969 Tax Reform Act and concluded that it was the intention of Congress to make them exercise the judicial power of the United States. They said that they exercised the judicial power to the exclusion of executive power and administrative power and legislative power.
So you don't disagree that our territorial courts exercise judicial power?
I do disagree,
Your Honor. That's the problem. You're simply wrong in your assertion that judicial power is only found in an Article III court. That's just simply wrong.
We do not say that judicial power is only found in an Article III court.
So why territorial courts do exercise judicial power?
Territorial courts exercise power that is pursuant to Article IV, and they decide matters in the mode of judges, in a quasi-judicial mode, but we do not say that they exercise the judicial power. We rely specifically, and we do not challenge Freitag versus Commissioner's
Holden. Leave out the. Do they exercise judicial power?
Right.
They exercise adjudicative power. We have several instances where we have territorial courts that do not exercise the judicial power of the United States. The opinion in Freitag says the judicial power. It says they exercise a portion of the judicial power of the United States. Now,
What was the result in Freitag?
In Freitag was that the court concluded 9-0 that the tax court was a part of the courts of law, and that the courts of law could properly be vested with the power to appoint inferior officers, in this particular case, special trial judges. The special trial judges then were constitutionally appointed. So it was 9-0 loss for the taxpayer in that case. The interesting point is the sharp division with regard to the rationale, which is the 5-4 point. Justice Blackmun's opinion and Justice Scalia's opinion are sharp odds. Justice Scalia understood the implications of what was being said by Justice Blackmun. Indeed, he cited Boucher versus Sinar, expressing his concern that in an appropriate case, if one came forward and charged that, wait a second, you've created an institution that exercises the judicial power of the United States and yet sometimes is subject to removal for malfeasance, inefficiency, and neglect of duty, that this presents a very dire problem.
The Supreme Court addressed it in Estrada. I don't know what you're talking about. And they don't talk about a territorial judge. They say the president may remove a judge who serves on an Article I court. And they exercise judicial power.
If I can direct the court to the language of footnote 35 in Estrada. If the court reads further, that the court addresses what issue they did not address in Estrada. And the issue that they did not address in Estrada was that issue which is addressed by the paramount concern of our separation of powers in footnote 35. And so footnote 35 in Estrada says the paramount concern is that some power, in this case, executive power.
You're not reading it. You stopped reading it.
I don't have the language.
At the footnote. I'm looking at it. You know, I'm following my teacher now. Read the language. That's not what the language says. The footnote doesn't say what you're trying to say by paraphrasing it. The paramount concern in Brownjohn that Congress was accreting to itself the power to control the functions of another branch is not implicated by a removal provision, like the one at issue here, which provides no control in one branch over the constitutionally assigned mission of another branch. That follows the reference to the president may remove a judge who serves on an Article I court.
And so the last part of the language, Your Honor, Judge Edwards, is the relevant language, is the constitutionally assigned mission of another branch. And so here we have the constitutionally assigned mission of another branch.
Article I branch? Article I court?
No, Your Honor. That is the judicial power of the United States that is most commonly exercised traditionally within Article III, but not exclusively, according to Freitag versus Commissioner. And that was what Justice Scalia complained about here. And so this is not removing a tax court judge from a committee assignment where they're going to be part-time freelancing to advise the Sentencing Commission. This is removing them from their very functions that they exercise as officers of the tax court. They would no longer exercise that. We believe the appropriate remedy in this instance is not what the IRS has suggested we're seeking. It's the more limited remedy of severance. What we ask is that this court strike 7443F, that it hold it is unconstitutional and sever it from the Organic Act of the tax statute, and vacate the decision below and set us down for...
I want to get to what it is we would do if we found this was unconstitutional. You don't have anywhere to send it back to below if we go with your constitutional argument. You're back where you started, owing the taxes, not having any relief, and you don't have anywhere to go for it. If we strike down the constitutionality of the tax court judge.
Judge Sattel, we don't ask that this court strike down in toto the tax court. The relief we seek is more limited. We seek...
I don't understand how it follows from your prayer.
So
if this court, as it's constituted, is unconstitutional because of the presidential control, then it's gone, isn't it? They couldn't do anything. They can't benefit. You're the one who wanted the court to act, and now you're saying this court can't exist constitutionally. I don't understand where you get to if you win this.
So Judge Sattel, we do not argue that if the 7443F statute were severed from the Organic Act, that the president then has a plenary power to remove the judges. That plainly would...
I'm not suggesting that. You're suggesting that the president's power of removal here renders this judge improper, this court improperly in...
And ordinarily, Joe Suntell, I would agree with you. The Supreme Court and Justice Blackmun, however, in his opinion in Freitag versus Commissioner, created a bit of a conundrum here where it recognized that the tax court exercises the judicial power of the United States. It may be that the Supreme Court has to clean
it
up its own.
It recognizes it exercises the judicial power of the United States. Fine. We'll take that. It did that. No question. It does. Now, you're saying that because of that, the president can't have the power of removal of a judge. This judge has been appointed, these judges have been appointed under a statute to give the president that power. They're not properly constituted, so we got nowhere to send this back. Do we just reverse it, throw it out, and you have no remedy, right?
Well, if the court were to decide that the appropriate remedy was to strike down the tax court in toto constitutionally, and in having done so would vacate the...
What you're asking for is excision of the provision that codifies the president's removal power.
That's correct, Your Honor. So we only ask...
We can get it loose. This doesn't look severable to me. If he's appointed a person to an office with a particular description, and that description is unconstitutional, I don't say that's severable.
I think that the germaneness doctrine with respect to the appointments issue, that this still remains germane. This court in Intercollegiate Broadcasting, for example, which is an appointments clause case written, I believe it was Judge Williams, in that case, it severed the removal, in that particular instance, the removal restriction on the copyright royalty judges. And sent the matter back down. The issue there was, were the copyright royalty judges constitutionally appointed? The argument being they were principal officers and were not appropriately appointed subject to the accepting clause, that they should have been appointed through the advice and consent process. In that case, the court concluded the appropriate remedy was to sever the removal restriction on the copyright judges, thereby making them subordinate officers, inferior officers within the meaning of Edmund, and subject then as inferior officers properly to appointment by the Librarian of Congress. And so that's another example of a removal restriction that was not deemed to be the Organic Act in toto. Again, we think that 7443F is the only problem here. Of course, would we be delighted if we could have an Article III tax court that could actually act as a bulwark as against the IRS? Absolutely. But that's not the remedy that we seek today. And perhaps Congress will explore that at some point in the future. But the sole remedy we look for is for this particular provision to be severed, that for it to be vacated, and for it to be sent back down for a new decision, as was done in the copyright royalty case by the circuit. And the second point that I would like to make with respect to the power is that neither is this a rule-bound analysis that is offered in the Freytag opinion. That is, Freytag did not understand, the majority did not understand itself to be uniquely interpreting the appointments clause. It understood itself to be holistically interpreting the meaning of courts, of the courts of law. And there's some evidence to this.
So for purposes of the appointments clause, I mean, that text appears in the appointments clause, so that necessarily the opinion...
So absolutely, it was an interpretation for the purposes of the appointments clause. But the court also said that the principle of separation of powers is embedded in that particular clause, the appointments clause. There is no separation of powers clause. And the court said, in order to properly interpret what the courts of law means and what heads of departments means, we're going to look at the cognate provisions of the Constitution. That is, using the Constitution as its own dictionary, we're going to intratextually look through at other places where the use of heads of departments is used in order to be able to determine whether this is a part of the heads of departments or not. They looked at the president's opinion power. They looked at the 25th Amendment and other places. And then with respect to the courts of law, they similarly concluded in this holistic, same analytical method, to use the words that they used. I see my time is concluded.
Can you tell me, what is your, now that I understand your remedy, what is the redress, thinking it in standing terms?
Yeah.
The redress is you want to go back to the same court that you now claim you shouldn't have had to go to because the president can remove. Now, what is it that is now better for you in terms of relief if we excise the president's removal power?
Yes.
How are you, your client, better off?
So the redress that we seek would be a new proceeding before an adjudicator not subject to presidential removal.
Yeah, and why? I'm just curious.
It's the problem of the here and now subservience that adjudicator was previously laboring under. That is the peril and anxiety.
And don't you get relief? I mean, don't you get a review from that form automatically if you want it?
I'm sorry, you mean...
Don't you get review?
Our Article 3 review from the tax court?
Yes.
So that unfortunately, is not the complete remedy that one could seek, because, as you know, having written the book on it, that appellate review with respect to clearly erroneous facts, as the deferential treatment, the abuse of discretion standard is deferential. Justice Brennan, in his plurality in Northern Pipeline versus Marathon, said that problematic arrangement under the 1978 Bankruptcy Act could not be cured by appellate review by an Article III court, especially the case here where any appellate review by a flawed tribunal would necessarily be under some deferential standard, except for legal issues, which would be where preserved de novo review. And so for that matter, we believe that we could properly be redressed, and this would be consistent with the remedy offered in intercollegiate broadcasting, where the court severed the removal power, vacated the order below, and sent, in that particular case, the complaining party back down to the same copyright royalty judges for a new proceeding. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Bethany Hauser for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. This is a case about essentially a linguistic conundrum. The tax court is simultaneously not an Article III court, but also, as the court held in Freytag, it is a court of law within the meaning of the Appointments Clause. As the court said in Freytag, it exercises a portion of the judicial power, but at the same time, because it's not an Article III court, it can't exercise the judicial power of the United States within the meaning of Article III. Once we understand that that problem is essentially just linguistic, the apparent problem goes away. Therefore, I'm essentially arguing that the judicial power referred to in Freytag is not the judicial power of the United States, as that phrase is used in separation of powers analysis, and there's no separation of powers, therefore no separation of powers problem here.
What is judicial power then, and where is the tax court found in your view amongst the branches?
The first part of your question was, what is judicial power? As that phrase is used in Freytag, I think judicial power means the power to resolve issues in the manner of the courts of law. Resolution of issues on an individual basis, taking judicial form.
So no different from an adjudication by an agency?
No different. In Freytag, it may be, Freytag might be talking about a slightly more formal version, but I think that the distinction is not the separation of powers power, but the formality of the adjudication, if there is a distinction. So that you could have agency boards that are not courts of law for purposes of the appointments clause. But that distinction would be formality, not the types of cases they decide or the fact that they decide them by determining facts and applying the law to the facts. And that understanding of judicial power is also consistent with McAllister. The court, the territorial court in McAllister, had all the powers of a district court and a state court. It must qualify as a court of law under the Freytag analysis, too. So that would be a second type of court that would fall into that same category with the tax court. Probably, I think, also bankruptcy courts have been mentioned here.
What do you do with the language in Freytag where the court said the tax court remains independent of the executive and legislative branches?
Well, the tax court...
It plays an exclusively judicial role.
Tax court judges are subject to... Tax court judges are relatively independent of those other branches. The Federalist 47, and this is discussed in Mistretta, it's understood that the principal parts of the three branches can have overlapping authority. And what we see with the tax court is overlapping authority. Tax court decisions are reviewable by the Article III courts. The president has appointment and removal power. And at the same time, Congress retains the ability to impeach tax court judges. The Senate retains the ability to reconfirm after their term of office has expired. So there's overlapping authority over the tax court, and that overlapping authority creates independence in the tax court. In fact, James Madison, in the segment from the Annals of Congress that we cited in our brief, suggests just that sort of overlapping authority to produce a subordinate body within the federal government that would nevertheless be able to exercise independent judgment in deciding questions that arise between an individual and the government. You asked me to what form of power does the tax court exercise. It's certainly possible that it exercises executive power. And we cited footnote 4 from City of Arlington versus FCC, where the court suggests that everything that is not, every power not exercised by an Article III court or by Congress itself must be executive power. And I think if it has to be just one kind of power, then it has to be executive power under that analysis. It's also possible, though, in the passage from the Annals of Congress, James Madison refused to say whether the controller was exercising executive or judicial power. The tax court's power is very similar to the controller's power that they were debating in the First Treasury Act. So I would not like to disavow Mr. Madison's view that those powers might be inextricably intertwined in this particular role. But I think it would be that this arrangement for controlling that intermingling of powers would be acceptable for the reasons he gave in his proposal in 1789. It may not be necessary for the court to reach the merits of the constitutional issue anyway. Obviously, the tax court refused to reach it on the grounds that it had not been raised early enough. It's obviously a little troubling, if not impossible, for a person to invoke the authority of a court and then wait until he receives a solution he does not like to then argue that the court is fundamentally misconstituted. And also, there is this problem that even if the taxpayers prevail by showing that the tax court exercises judicial power for purposes of the separation of powers analysis, then it would seem to follow under Stone versus Marshall that they can't exercise that judicial power at all because they are not Article III judges with lifetime appointments. And that would leave taxpayers with no remedy. And we don't think they can make an argument that will leave them without a remedy, or they can't prevail on an argument that will leave them with no remedy here.
As I understand you, implicit in your argument is that to the extent that the president has removal of power, it does not really reach to tax court judges' exercise of judicial power. It is a limited removal authority.
It is a limited removal
authority. And that is our way of dealing with these things. I mean, we've been doing it for a long time. The removal authority is not for anything. It's with notice and hearing, inefficiency, neglect of duty, and malfeasance in office, but for no other cause. Seems to me that's the carve-out. I mean, we understand you can have judicial power in some offices that are not Article III offices.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And I think that comes from Humphrey's executor. There's the Weiner case. Understand these non-Article III bodies that nevertheless have to exercise independent judgment, and that's the way we achieve it, and that's consistent with James Madison's exposition where he argued against the controller in 1789 serving at the pleasure of the president. The merits of the actual collection due process procedure in this case have also been briefed. If there are no questions about the penalty issue or the merits of the CDP proceeding, we'll rest on our brief on those issues. Thank you.
Ms. Thurman, does Mr. Samahan have rebuttal time? We'll give you 2 minutes to wrap up.
Thank you. I'd like to make 3 points. Point number one, counsel for the IRS says that Justice Blackmun and the Supreme Court majority engaged in a simple linguistic error when they characterized the power being exercised by the tax court as the judicial power. I would recommend a close reading of Freytag. I think the text speaks for itself in what they understood that they were doing. They said it was the judicial power of the United States. And the concurring justices who dissented separately with respect to the rationale, they also understood what that meant, and they were concerned about the implications. Freytag has not been overruled by the Supreme Court. It continues to be the law of the land on this particular point. City of Arlington versus FCC and Stern versus Marshall both did say that in order to exercise the judicial power of the United States, one must have Article III tenure. That adopts Justice Scalia's separately concurring rationale. That would overrule Freytag if they had specifically addressed Freytag. They have not specifically addressed Freytag on this particular point. And so this court is bound by Freytag in its characterization of the tax court's power, and until which point the Supreme Court were to revisit this specific issue, the characterization of the tax court and its power. The second point that I want to make is that with respect to the tax court being independent from the executive and the legislature, it was independent from the executive and legislature only in this sense, in that they are not subject to review by the legislature or the executive. It said nothing about and was not addressed at all in the Freytag majority opinion whether in the very first instance these judges are tainted because of their capacity to be removed. Again, the Supreme Court has spoken on this power, malfeasance, inefficiency, and neglect to duty. Those are very broad grounds, says Bauscher. And we're finally told, lastly, that this court should not hear this matter, which is my third point. This court has discretion to hear this matter in addition to it being a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted.